Welcome to Wealthion. I'm Wealthion founder Adam Taggart, welcoming you back for another weekly market recap with my good friend Lance Roberts. Lance, it's been a really wet week out here in California. I hope you guys are drier there in Texas.
We've had a little bit of rain, but overall, we're doing better than you.
Okay. Although I think Texas can say that about California on a lot of dimensions.
Yeah, maybe.
All right. Look, lots to talk about here. Let's start following up on a discussion we had last week when you were talking about how all of the, a lot of the daily moving averages, the 20, the 50, the 100, were all converging at 3,900. And you said if the S&P can basically break above that and close, then that might be quite bullish for the market in the short term. This week ended with the S&P at about 4,000. So it seems like we are, above that 3,900 level. Yep. Is it breakout time?
We have to go back here for just a moment, back to October, and talk about what happened then. So in October, we kind of set the lows for the market at that point. We were, this was post Jerome Powell at the Jackson Hole Summit coming in and said, hey, we're not going to stop hiking rates anytime soon. Stocks sold off on disappointment. Of course, we had that rally in June and July on the pivot hope. Then, of course, as when we hit that low in October, you and I talked about here on the show that markets were very oversold. We were set up for a nice counter trend rally in the markets because our MACD buy signal had gotten extremely oversold, was starting to turn up, and we kind of get this push into the markets. And of course, we did, and asset prices rose in November. All the pivot hopes come back again. So the bulls get all excited. Oh, the Fed's gonna stop hiking rates. We got above the 200-day moving average, which was also that downtrend line from the January highs. We lasted there for about a day or so, rolled back over again. And we had warned in November that December, the first part of December, would be very weak because of mutual fund rebalancing, tax loss selling, that type of thing. And of course, that's the way December started. And then, of course, Jerome Powell came out at the December FOMC meeting and says, we're not going to stop hiking rates. Yeah. Markets sell off into the end of December. So markets got very oversold. Now, here's the difference this time is that the markets are rallying. And this time we're pushing up into that 200-day moving average, which is also that downtrend line from the January highs of last year. But we're doing it this time, instead of being on a MACD sell signal like we were last time when we broke above the 200-day, we're actually on a buy signal. So this is a much more bullish setup for stocks, at least in the very short term. And we did add some exposure very early this week. We added a trading position in RSP. We also added a little bit of exposure to financials. We had sold energy back when energy had peaked a couple of months ago. We added some energy back to our portfolio as well. So, we're taking on a little bit more risk exposure here at the moment because we kind of have this nice little bullish setup going. We're also entering earnings season as well. Earnings kicked off today. We have JP Morgan, United Healthcare, Bank of America, Wells Fargo. We've got lots of earnings going next week as well. We're in blackout period coming up here for the Fed. So we'll have less talk from the Fed because the Fed meeting is at the beginning of February. That'll be the next time we really get to hear from Jerome Powell. So, there's going to be less news flow. And of course, I guess we'll talk about inflation as well. That inflation number continues to come down as we expect. We talked about last June, you and I were getting a bunch of grief because we were talking about inflation was going to peak and turn lower. And it was just a function of math, as we said back then, and the math is now kicking in pretty well. So all that's feeding in to a very bullish backdrop for stocks short term. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that we're about to enter into the next big bull market. We're going to, run off to all-time highs. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying from a trading perspective right now, there's an opportunity to make some money. We're trying to participate with that in our portfolios to put a little bit of, gain on our books as we start the new year.
Okay. I guess we'll just be watching things really closely here over the next week or two to see if those bullish indicators, continue to all get ticked off. But it seems like you're saying you think that there's enough of a short-term potential here that you're beginning to add a little bit back to your portfolio when you were raising cash at the end of last year. And maybe those actions say more than any words. You said we're going into earnings season right now. And I think one of the really big questions for 2023 is, are earnings estimates still too overly optimistic? And you and I have been talking about this for a long time. I think they are. I'm just going to put up a chart here from the Daily Shot, which shows consensus analyst earnings estimates right now going forward into next year and into 2024, and they just keep mounting. So they're not factoring in any sort of discount yet for an economic slowdown or even a recession. I was interviewing Ted Oakley yesterday. That interview is going to go live next week. But he was saying, you know, I think roughly S&P earnings estimates right now are something like $235 a share. And he says he has a really hard time making a credible argument for anything above $200 a share. And, you know, obviously we're going to find out. But right now, as we go into earnings seasons, we're going to start hearing companies adjust their forward outlooks here. What's your gut telling you here? Is this going to be the start of them trying to manage expectations downwards that are going to, you know, force the analysts to start having to bring their earnings down? Or could there still be a little bit of oomph left enough in the tank to kick this can for another quarter?
Well, they've already been doing this. And look, we've been writing about this now for the last year. I mean, you can go back on our website at realinvestmentadvice.com and just type in earnings in the search bar at the top, and you'll just get article after article about earnings being, you know, overly ambitious, and that earnings had to come down. In fact, going into June of last year, analysts were still hiking their earnings estimates. Since then, earnings estimates have already declined by 12% going into this reporting season that we're about to start really in earnest on Monday. You know, I call this millennial earnings season because, you know, analysts, we lower the earnings until every company can kind of get over it. And this is why every earnings season we always have is like 75% of companies beat earnings estimates. Right. Well, yeah, if you keep lowering the estimate, eventually everybody can get over it. So I call it millennial earnings season because everybody gets a trophy by the time it's the end of earnings season. But yeah, those estimates still have to come down. And look, there's a big differential. And, you know, you got to be careful, I guess, who you get earnings from. I get my earnings from S&P. FactSet has a different set of earnings that they use. So that's where you get that $235 number is from FactSet. S&P, which actually reports the earnings for the S&P 500 companies, I use their earnings estimates because it's their index. So I figure that's probably closer to accurate. That's currently at $203 a share. Now that's down from about $240 back in June of this past year. So you know, 240 to 203, that's a pretty big drop. The long-term median right now is around 160. So in a recession, if we have a recession this year, you should expect earnings to drop to somewhere between 160 and $180 a share. So definitely more downside for earnings. And again, what this is going to come down to, obviously, is whether or not you have a recession. I'm writing an article right now about the National Federation of Independent Business, one of my favorite surveys that's put out. Nobody pays attention to the NFIB survey, but 50% of the economy or 50% of employment is driven by small businesses. So that survey has a lot of input into the actual economy. And if you ever want a good indicator, if you're a small cap investor and want to know whether you should buy small cap stocks or not, take a look at the NFIB survey. The confidence survey has a very high correlation to small cap stocks. Right now, as an example, there's a big divergence between small cap stocks, which have been rallying at the beginning of this year because everybody's like, oh, small caps are going to do great this year. They don't do well in a recession. And NFIB confidence, which has now turned a lot lower. So that gap is going to play catch up. NFIB leads small cap stocks by about 3 to 4 months. So, you know, what NFIB is telling you right now is that a recession is coming. The question is only how deep is it? And if you have a recession, that leads to negative earnings growth, which is where you're going to start seeing these earnings revisions come down a lot more. So, you know, to your point, still agree with you. Estimates are still too high if we have a recession. If we don't have a recession, and you and I have talked about possibilities versus probabilities last week, you know, we have to give some credence here to the soft recession, you know, no recession scenario camp. You know, if we can avoid a recession, then earnings are probably about fairly valued for a no recession type scenario right now. I have a hard time getting, you know, to that point, considering that we're still so deviated. We're 20% above the long-term trend growth of earnings. And that's a very high level historically that is unable, you can't sustain that kind of deviation from the long-term growth trend forever. So either we're going to have a deeper recession this year than many expect, or earnings are going to just, the growth of earnings, right, the growth rate of earnings is going to slow until earnings get back towards their long-term growth trend. So, you know, one of those two things are ultimately going to have to happen.
All right. So, I mean, I guess because we're going into earnings season right here, if a recession is close enough, that's going to start being reflected in the forward guidance of these companies that they announce at their earnings calls. So my point is we're going to have to, you know, pay particular attention over the next couple of weeks as we hear the results of these earnings calls. And that could be something that this technically improving, you know, these improving market technicals, they may slam into the brick wall of forward guidance downward revisions. Not saying that's what's going to happen, but that's one of the things that probably could happen if indeed a recession is closer than many expect. You agree?
Well, two things. One, you remember that markets work off of sentiment, right? So it's expectations. You know, for the last year, all we've talked about for a year now is the recession, the recession, the recession, the recession, the recession's coming. It's going to be a recession. It's like everything's terrible, right? That's all we talked about for a year. And in the course of that last year, if you take a look at the market, we had a low in October. We had a low in June of last year, had that low in October, which is a lower low. And we've now had a higher low in December. So if you take a look at a chart, that's an inverse head and shoulders with your neckline that runs right along the 200-day moving average at the moment. So if you an inverse head and shoulders is a very bullish pattern setup, right, and it suggests that sentiment in the market is overall improving. So here's the issue. So both JP Morgan and Bank of America reported earnings on Friday. They both said, hey, we think there's going to be a slight recession this year. We're preparing for it, right? We're Bank of America. We're preparing for the worst. And we just think it'll be a slight recession, but we're preparing for the worst. Mm-hmm. So they're putting all that information out there into the markets saying, hey, this is what's coming. So the market is pricing all this stuff in. And the question always becomes, market and the right event. So here's the rub. If we do have just a slight recession, right, and maybe economic growth goes negative for a quarter, maybe two, right, and then starts to turn up, and employment stays fairly solid, and jobless claims don't go shooting off to the moon. There's a lot of ifs here, right? But the point is, you know, if you can work your way through a situation to where it's this very slight economic downturn, then markets probably have it right. And that's what markets are trying. That's why markets are running right now. And that's what these technical setups are telling you, is that market sentiment as a whole is improving. So if you're over in this camp of being super bearish, you got to kind of give some credence to what the market's trying to tell you, because markets predict, you know, outcomes by about 6 months. So the markets are building in this story that we're going to have a softer economic recession and not some type of terrible economic financial crisis event. Now, what happens if we have a terrible financial crisis event type thing because the Fed's hiking rates, you know, to 5.25%, they don't back off the pedal, you know, whatever, of course. Nick Timiraos yesterday came out with an article talking on Thursday, came out with an article saying one and done, one more rate hike this year and the Fed's going to stop. So that's another reason markets have been rallying the last couple of days. But if we do have some type of really bad economic recession outcome, markets are not priced for that. We're going to have another decline, 10-15% down to try to price that in to get valuations down. So, you know, that's the trick to the market this year, is technicals are telling you one thing. It's easy to get emotionally tied up into the data on a longer term view, and we can talk about all those potential risks, and they're certainly there. And I'm not discounting those at all. I'm not saying you should ignore them. I'm just saying we have to kind of balance both sides of the equation and say, what do the markets know potentially that I don't know? Or what has the market got that I may be wrong about? That's what we're trying to feel our way through right now.
Right, right. If I could sort of distill down an important part of what you said, it's no matter what happens, the question is it better or worse than what the market had already priced in, right? Whether it's a mild recession, moderate recession, severe recession, it all depends on what the market's already pricing in for, right? And so you can still get bad news, but if it's not as bad as what the market was expecting, then that could be bullish for financial asset prices. Right. So obviously we'll be watching this closely. And you're doing the right thing, Lance, which is always, you know, keep us cognizant of the other side of the argument so we don't get too wedded to one particular out view. I will say the thing that I have trouble thinking that the market has really, you know, effectively priced in a recession or at least even a strong weakening of the economy this year is the fact that earnings estimates appear to still be so high, right? They just don't, but you know, look, as you always say, look, one data point doesn't, you know, define the future, right? So we'll be watching.
So yeah, but look, you know, it's a great point, Adam. And, you know, the thing is I can go through a litany. Look, I've been writing articles for the last couple of weeks talking about a litany of data points that certainly suggest there's more trouble coming, right? You know, so again, we talked about earnings right now, 20% above the long-term growth trend. It's unsustainable. It's one of the highest peaks on record. Profit margins are at a very high level for corporations, which is unsustainable. The only reason that profit margins are where they are is because we injected $5 trillion worth of cash into households and then fired everybody. So all of a sudden, these corporations had a bunch of demand, right? No employees. What inventory they had, they were selling at massive prices, which created these big profit margins. So without that same environment, profit margins can't stay at historic highs. So profit margins have to come down. Valuations are still elevated by any stretch of the imagination. Interest rates are at the highest level since 1980. Whenever you've had inflation above 5%, whenever you've had interest rates above 5%, you've always had a recession, and a pretty bad one at that one. So, you know, this is the conundrum, right? I mean, you know, I can sit here with you and I can get through all the economic data. I can get you through all the financial data that says you should be in a bunker with beanie weenies and ammo right now, because the next year is going to be the worst bear market ever on record, period, the end. Markets are up for the year, by the way.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is why it's so hard to manage money. And, you know, we were talking about returns last week in the video. And, you know, this is why when you talk about, you know, your portfolio, don't get tied up in what happened from January to December. That calendar year means nothing about anything. Look at your portfolio over a 2 or 3 year time frame. How did you do relative to what your goal was that you were trying to get to? Strip out some of this volatility that happens in the middle, because that leads us to make really bad financial decisions. And, you know, the day, you know, performance last year sucked. The market sucked last year. I was trying to think of a better word earlier today, but there isn't one. It just sucked.
Just be honest. Yeah.
You know, it was just volatile. It was up and down. Nothing really worked right. You know, but we're now coming into this, into a new year. So, you know, again, you know, it's important to have, I think, you know, as we were saying, we've got to keep an eye on both camps, and whichever one starts to perform one way or the other, you know, good or bad, we just need to adapt to whatever that is. And, you know, we talked about last week, you know, on the show, our word of the year is audible, which is, I may be on the show one week saying, hey, we're buying stocks because markets are going up. Next week, I may be on here going, we sold everything.
Right, right.
You know, just be aware that, you know, if you miss a show one week, you may miss whatever happens.
That's a great point. And I'll just underscore too, that you can make this point much better than I, Lance, but like, again, one of the values of a really good financial advisor is to help you you know, plan for the unexpected, help you create a plan, but then also create a contingency plan. Because again, you know better than I from your decades of experience, the market history is just littered with dead bodies because the market didn't do what it should.
Right. Yeah. No, absolutely. Look, I've got several of my previous bodies are laid out there for the same reasons. So, you know, I'm down to, my 9 lives are down to about 3. So.
All right. Well, guard those jealously. We need you around. All right, Lance. So we are still finishing up the first bullet point of like my 20 bullet point list here. Right. So I got to move on here. We had some news this week. We had the CPI release. Right, it came in at 6.5%. You mentioned real briefly that the disinflation that you and I predicted, I think at this point it's manifested. It's a clear trend. I think we're off by like a month in terms of when the CPI peak was, but since then it's been a steady downbeat, and I think we feel confident saying it is likely to continue this trajectory for much of the rest of this year. Right. Sure. That was sort of the target for Wall Street, and it certainly didn't, you know, cause an issue in the markets at all. What didn't remain high enough to freak the markets out. So I guess before we move on here, is there just anything about the CPI that you want to reinforce for folks here?
Well, no, it's a clarification more than anything else. I've been getting a lot of emails about it this week, and the emails are inflation came down, but it's nowhere near 2%. And so the Fed's going to have to keep hiking rates to like 50% to get it down to 2%, yep, whatever the number was. That's not what the Fed said. The Fed did not say, we are going to keep hiking rates until we get to 2%. That's not what they said. What they said was, we are looking for a sustainable trajectory towards our target of 2%. That has become clearly apparent. This is now going to give the one thing the Fed is afraid of is a repeat of the 1970s, where we had a run in inflation, it tailored off, and then took off again. That's what they're afraid of. And part of that came from wages. Wages have rolled over. Wages are declining on a real basis. There is a clear path lower now for inflation. So this is going to give the Fed some room to start potentially dropping to a quarter basis point hike. If Nick Timiraos is right, this next rate hike will be the last one. And they'll say, we're going to hike and we're going to pause here and see how things work out. Because again, as we talked about here on the show, there's this huge lag effect. All these rate hikes have not even come into the market yet. So the Fed, and the Fed's aware of that. They're not stupid. So they've got to pause.
That's why they want to wait. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. They got to pause and let some of this stuff catch up and make sure they didn't over tighten, which I think they did. But we'll see. We'll see what happens. But, you know, if you take a look at M2 money supply, and took the year-over-year rate of change. And by the way, there's about a 70% correlation between M2 money supply and inflation. They're on about a 12-month lag. So think about when we started injecting the economy with all that M2, fast forward 12 months, fast forward another 12 months, here we are. M2 is negative. Now that growth rate of M2 is now negative.
So, and that's sorry to interrupt. I'm going to let you keep talking, but I'm going to be putting up a chart here from Ted Oakley. I got this from my conversation with him yesterday. It's a yearly chart of M2 growth since 1960, year by year. And you can see every single year of the chart, M2 has grown except for this year.
Yeah, exactly.
So it truly is different this time based upon that one metric.
Exactly. And what that tells you is that inflation, and again, we talked about the economic pig and the fiscal python, I'm sorry, the fiscal pig and the economic python last week. That monetary surge is now coming out of the pig. So, you know, inflation is going to fall. The trick is going to be, and I think the big point here to make is, do we have just disinflation that gets us down to 2%, or do we wind up with negative inflation, or i.e. deflation, which is the Fed's big problem?
Right, right. And there have been folks on this channel in the not too distant past who are banking more on deflation, but we'll take more of a wait and see approach here. And one thing I want to note on that too is, if you looked at the 6.5% inflation number that came out, what was really propping that number up was housing.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. And if you know, that's one of the lagging indicators that goes into CPI, right? So if you look at more real time data for this. Rents are coming down already, right? The housing, we're going to talk about the housing correction here in a minute because you wrote a really good article about it. But basically the thing that is most propping up the CPI right now is something that we can already tell from the real-time data is rolling over. So we should, that should also lead to a lower CPI print.
Absolutely. Now, the rent makes up about almost 40% of the index. So homeowners equivalent rent. If you take a look at like Zillow rent indexes and all that, those aren't going down. They're crashing.
So, right.
You know, and
that's enough. And I'll explain why on that in a bit, but not fast enough for me personally. Let me put it that way.
There's about a 3-month lag though. And so, yeah, that's all starting to show up now and it's going to really catch up in the next two reports.
Yeah. So I won't hold you to this, but do you expect the rate of drop in the CPI to increase from here over the next couple of months?
So a couple of things are going to happen. So when we talked about the bath, which is, you know, if you look back historically, this time last year, we were kicking off, you know, 1% rates of inflation, right? The monthly change in May was big like 1.2%. Yep. Yeah. So when we get to April, May, I can't remember the exact month, but there's like more than a 1% jump in a month. So when we get to that month, you're going to have a big drop in inflation because of the year-over-year comparison. Now, once we get past that, about August, September, those rates come down fairly sharply. So once we get into those months, the rate of decrease will start to slow down pretty dramatically until we get to, you know, this time next year, you know, we'll be back to normal. But this time next year, we should be close to 2-3%.
Okay. And I'll let you make an audible call on this as we get into the year. But sounds like you think things are going to start really, you know, waterfalling downward faster on the CPI perspective and then kind of tailing off and, you know.
Yeah, exactly. And look, that jives with if you believe we're having a recession, that's got to happen.
Right. And just to be real clear for folks, if we're pushing any triggers here, we're talking about reported inflation through the CPI. What you see, what you experience in the real world may be very different, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Don't put real life into government numbers. Those don't jive.
Yeah. All right. Well, the other big announcement this week was we heard from Powell, right, on Tuesday, and he said some important things or some interesting things, and I want to get your reaction to them. So when he did come out and did his usual "look, guys, I'm serious" talk, right, he said, quote, "restoring price stability when inflation is high can require measures that are not popular in the short term as we raise interest rates to slow the economy." So again, it's him saying, guys, I'm super serious. I'm going to, you know, it's going to require some pain. I'm not going to back off. Don't doubt me, right? Of course, the market's still saying, we don't know. He also said, which is, maybe this is just jawboning, but I thought it was interesting that he decided to harp on it. He said, "the absence of direct political control over our decisions allows us to take these necessary measures without considering short-term political factors." So that's sort of his way of saying, I don't care how much everybody screams. I don't care how much Biden is knocking on my door to bring rates down. I'm going to do what needs to be done to slay inflation. Now, you can believe that or you don't have to, but the fact that he's sort of understating it, it's still more of that, like I'm wrapping the Volcker mantle around me. You're laughing the whole time I'm saying this.
I am, because if you actually listen to that speech, it was actually quite humorous, because your point is like he's sitting there declaring independence. But actually listen to what he said in the speech. If you remember about right after Biden got elected and we started doing all of this, you know, stimulus payments, and we're going to pass the bills to affect climate change and all this stuff, both he and Yellen came out and said, yeah, you know, part of what we can do is, you know, we can help the impact of climate change through monetary policy, fiscal policy, blah, blah, blah. He was all in that camp. Then the Republicans take control of the House, and there's probably a pretty good chance there'll be a change of control in 24 in the White House. And now he's going, oh, yeah, we're politically independent. We have nothing to do with climate change. And that was the big message of that speech. So he's already shifting camp politically. Look, all we have to do is go back to 2018. In 2018 is a good example of this. Donald Trump's in office. You remember this. He's hiking rates in September, says we're nowhere close to the neutral rate. Market declines 20% between October and December. Trump comes out and is threatening to fire Powell. And within a week, Powell changes tones and says, oh, we're right at the neutral rate. We're good. And then starts cutting rates the following June. So
that's the original Powell pivot. Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. So this whole idea that we're politically independent is complete BS because they want to keep their job just like anybody else.
Yeah. And which is funny because he also, one of the quotes I have here is he said, the Fed will not be a climate policymaker, right?
Exactly. That's my point.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, look, a couple other notable things. One is that in tandem with Powell, ECB President Christine Lagarde and one of the Bank of England's chief economists both came out. Lagarde said that she expects the ECB or that interest rate hikes from the ECB to rise significantly further, quote unquote. And the Bank of England's chief economist said that inflation could persist for longer and the Bank of England's going to have to take action on that. So they are basically holding hands united with Powell, saying that inflation's the big monster here and we are all going to keep hiking and tightening until it's slain, right? Again, we can argue about or debate how much we believe all these guys, but that is the public trajectory that they are taking pains to paint for everybody here. What I think is the really big question, and I'm going to put up a chart here for it, folks. And folks, it's a little fuzzy, but this is the best version of it I could get, which basically says, it's from Bloomberg, it's titled Market to Fed, The Economy Can't Handle Restrictive Rates for Long. And basically it just shows, if you look at the Fed's expected Fed funds rates projections out to November of 2024, and you look at what the market is pricing out to 2024, there is this growing gap as you get further out in time. And that gap is going to have to close. And I think, Lance, that is the big question right now, is which direction does it close in? Does the Fed capitulate or does the market get disappointed and then everything has to be repriced? I will say that in the article that accompanied this, CEO of the Philadelphia Fed, Patrick Harker, said, hey, you know, I don't think we need to overdo the monetary policy response. And so some people are thinking that that's an early indicator that the Fed may be blinking a little bit and that gap will close with the Fed doing less than it's saying and appeasing markets. But I'm curious, what do you think?
Well, no, I think that's what Nick Timiraos alluded to on Thursday, talking about potentially the Fed is, you know, potentially closer to their target rate and they may be one and done here coming up in the next meeting. But two things. One, and again, this is the one thing that we all have to go back and think about. The bulls are very excited about this idea of, we've said this before, but you know, the bulls are very excited about this pivot thing, right? Which is, okay, the Fed's going to stop hiking rates, so let's run stock prices up. That's not loosening monetary policy. And if the Fed gets to 5%, and just, you know, follow me through here for a second. Let's assume the Fed gets to 5% on their Fed funds rate. And they say, okay, great, we're going to hold it here. And the markets, so everybody goes, great, this is awesome. 5% Fed funds rate, it's awesome. Let's run stock prices up. The economy doesn't go into a recession. We have this soft landing. Stocks are doing great. Yields are, the bond market's doing okay. It's all functioning. Nothing's breaking. Why would the Fed cut rates, right? The market's predicting this idea that the Fed's going to start cutting rates as soon as July of this year. But why would the Fed cut rates if everything is fine? That's nirvana for the Fed. Think about it. If I'm the Fed, right? I'm tight. Oh, I forgot tightening the balance sheet, right? We're still doing 95
right,
billion.
Still continuing to do QT. Yep.
Yeah. So if everything is fine, this is awesome. I can reduce my balance sheet. I can keep rates at 5%. And if I ever have another recession, I got 5% of interest rates to drop to offset the next recession. So why on earth would I cut rates if everything is good? Right. So this is the disconnect that the market has from the Fed. The market keeps saying, oh, great, let's run stock prices up because the Fed's going to be cutting rates later this year. No, they're not going to cut rates if everything is fine. If they are cutting rates, everything's not fine and you don't want to be long stocks. So, you know, that's where I think the market's making a mistake. It makes no sense.
Well, what's interesting is what you're saying, Lance, is this gap may actually close from both directions, right? Yeah. Fed may not quite go as high as it says, but it's not going to go as low as the market thinks, and the market's going to have to readjust upwards, right?
Which means lower asset prices.
Right, which should bring asset prices down, exactly. And to your point, too, that's you did a really important distinction between pause and pivot. I just want to make sure the audience is really getting this, which is, pause does not mean the Fed is lowering rates, and QT is still going on, in the time being. So it still is tightening. But if the Fed holds it there, and then we get the backlog impact of all the rate hikes that have been, done so far, and you're correct, and that the Fed has already over-tightened, and then something really breaks, the market may get its pivot, but not for good reasons, right? Reasons that are not to be bullish on stocks. So again, we're just saying, look, you may get what you ask for, but it might not be what you want.
Exactly. No, and that's the thing I think we've got to just, be aware of and keep watching. Real quick, I wanted to step back to your comments about the BIS and the IMF talking about, inflation in the Eurozone.
Okay. It was ECB and BOE, but whatever. Sorry, it's all alphabet soup.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Sorry, ECB. They're also talking about potential recession, that type of thing, in the Eurozone. Emerging market stocks have been doing really well this year. International stocks have been doing really well out of the gate this year. Just be aware, right? If you're jumping into that, I'm buying emerging market stocks, international stocks, because they're cheap. They are not cheap relative to their own valuations. They're cheap relative to US stocks, but not necessarily cheap to their own historical valuations. But importantly, remember, emerging markets are commodity-based and they're very dependent on exports to developed countries. And so if we have a recession here, they're going to get the flu. So if they're going to have a recession there, emerging markets and international stocks may not provide you the safety net that you're hoping they will. So just, a lot of it will depend on economics.
Good point. I'd love to dig into that a little bit further, but that's going to have to wait for a future one because I'm still way behind here. All right. So another thing that just happened this week was Janet Yellen, Secretary of the Treasury, former chair of the Federal Reserve, is now raising the red flag that the U.S. is going to hit the debt limit ceiling by next Thursday, and that the Treasury is going to have to start taking extraordinary measures to avoid default. First question for you, Lance, is this meaningful or is this just kind of more of what we've always seen in the past?
First of all, I'm confused. I saw that headline today and I haven't had the chance to do all the research on it yet, but I'm not confused about the debt ceiling. What I'm confused about is I thought we just passed a $1.7 trillion spending bill. Am I wrong about that? Wasn't it just a couple of weeks ago we passed $1.7 trillion worth of funding for the next year? What happened to the money?
Good question.
I don't know. The House passed it. Did it not get passed in the Senate? And like I said, let me beg off on this question for right now. The debt ceiling is an issue. We're going to have to deal with it. We will raise the debt ceiling at some point. I need to figure out what happened to that $1.7 trillion continuing resolution for the spending bill. Because if that wasn't passed, then it's got to get passed so they've got funding for the next year. Otherwise, you'll have a government shutdown, which nobody wants. So, I don't think there's the tenor, even with the new Congress, I don't even think there's the tenor for a government shutdown. So we'll see.
Okay. So we'll punt on this topic until we have a little bit more data. I will just say from what I pulled here, Janet Yellen said, hey, we've got extraordinary measures that we can use the Treasury to keep things going until early June right now is what she's saying. Goldman Sachs issued a report saying they don't think the government's at risk of defaulting in the first half of this year. If things don't get resolved, then it's potentially in the second half of the year where we'd have some of those logjam issues you were talking about. I'll put up a chart here that sort of shows some of the key milestones here along the way if indeed nothing else changes between now and then. As we know, Lance, this will be a hyper political topic and I'm sure stuff's going to happen between now and then. But when we have more data, we'll come back on and talk about it.
Yeah.
OK, moving on to our next topic then, which I was going to make kind of the key theme of this week. I don't know if we've got a time to really sink our teeth totally into it. So I'll let you kind of drive. But you wrote a piece, Lance, and I got to call you out on this. Home prices will likely fall further.
Yeah.
Likely? I mean, are you really sticking your neck out there too much there, Lance? I mean, come on, buddy.
Rain may
be wet tomorrow, right?
Yeah, but... well, look, it's always one of those things where, if you say they will definitely fall further and then they don't, they're going to say, see, you were wrong.
Look, as you answer, I'm going to tell you what Zero Hedge, who reposted your article, the title they put on it, which I think they pulled from the article, was "The Current Housing Price Bubble Makes 2008 Look Quaint." All right. So maybe there's a little bit more relative context in that one. But OK, why don't you run here?
Well, no. So look, it's just if you take a look and you can put the chart up of home equity versus mortgage debt. There is such a massive gap. The immediacy of that chart is that we now have the highest level of home equity versus mortgage debt that we've had in history, right? It's just this massive deviation. And you go, well, that's a good thing, right? Everybody's sitting on a ton of equity. That's awesome. No, that's a function of house prices accelerating too much, right? So, people aren't paying off their mortgages in bulk. There's a steady trend of mortgage debt and how people deal with mortgage debt over time. So the equity is the deviation between that underlying debt, the price of the house accelerating way too much. So those have to come back at some point. And so if you take a look at a lot of the data as an example, and there's a chart in that article, which is on our website at realinvestmentadvice.com as well, if you want to pull down the article and read it. There's a chart there that shows median and average home prices. Now, let me throw a really big caveat out here to start with. Home prices are location specific. So, in California as an example, where Adam lives, home prices may not come down as much as they do in North Dakota, right? some other state. So, if like in Houston's a really good example. If you ever take a look at Houston, the city of Houston, kind of a 30,000 foot view, there's two rings in Houston. There's a loop called the 610 loop that runs around the city of Houston. That was the old city of Houston. And then there's the Beltway, which now runs, it's another ring around Houston as well. So we keep building these rings around Houston. Well, if you're inside that loop, what we call the 610 loop, if you're inner loop, right, this is where all the rich people live, those house prices don't go down because those are landlocked. There's no more land inner loop, and everybody wants to live inner loop because that's where all the hip restaurants are, et cetera. So, just when we're talking about this data, we're talking about national data. So we pulled data from the Census Bureau and ran some analysis on average and median prices across the nation. So you may say, Lance, you're wrong. Home prices in my area aren't going down. Quite possible, because you live in a region that has dynamics. Disclaimer. Okay. Now, the interesting point is about this article. If you take a look at the chart of median and average home prices, median average home prices rise over time in a pretty steady trend, about the rate of inflation, which is exactly what you would expect to happen. Following the recession in 2020 and this injection of all this liquidity in the markets, all these millennials and younger individuals ran out and started buying houses because people gave them a down payment, right? And there's this massive surge in the median and average home prices in houses because of all that liquidity hitting into the markets. Now, there's story after story, a story of these, millennials that ran out, bought houses sight unseen. They were just throwing bids out on houses. There was a great article on MarketWatch last week. A guy and his wife bought a house for $200,000 over asking price because they just had to have a house to live in, and then decided they didn't want to live there. And now they're talking about trying to sue the realtor for talking them into overpaying for this house, right? So yeah. That's just kind of the stuff that happens.
Yeah, and just to note, that's not a one-off. This is an article I've been circulating that a lot of people are doing this now. And good luck to them. I don't think they're going to get much, but, it's a thing.
It's a thing. We just sue everybody today. But anyway, but if you go through the point of the article is, and this is why that home prices likely have to come down more, is because that surge of $5 trillion in liquidity led to a surge in prices that was abnormal. That liquidity, going back to the economic, pig and python thing we talked about earlier, that liquidity's gone. So all these people that ran out, and this is the big thing, right? All these millennials ran out and bought houses. Who are they going to sell them to, right? And so when you start talking about supply, right, and another good chart in there is the supply. So you take a look at the number of people that are of age to buy a home versus the number of houses outstanding. Well, a lot of those there's a bunch of houses that are vacant for some reason. They are second homes that are owned by individuals. There's a whole variety of other reasons why a house is vacant and not being lived in, or it's being rented. So the supply dynamic versus households isn't necessarily as lean as everybody thinks it
right.
is. And supply has been rising very sharply, and that's a function of just the economic downturn, people going this. But here's the big question is, you know, without that liquidity, who's going to buy? If you want to sell your house and nobody's getting checks to come buy your house, that pool of potential buyers has shrunk a lot. So prices are going to have to come down to find that reasonable pool of buyers. And, you know, this, I think that's, and that's really kind of the jux of the article, is that there's just this excess got to come out.
Great. And that totally jives with the insights of my recent interview with Nick Jurley, the housing analyst. I know you're familiar with Nick, Lance. And he adds one other element. So there's the drop off in liquidity, right? Everybody got a bunch of free money to rush out, and there was FOMO behind it, right? Prices are going to the moon, and you may die if you stay in a city, right? You got to get out. You got to use this money to buy. So everybody scrambled. You then have the supply issues. And Nick says, you know, there's a whole bunch of factors going on there. In the most popular markets, the developers have been developing like crazy, right? So there's inventory that's finally beginning to come online. A bunch of it was stalled during COVID, right? Because they couldn't get the supplies they needed to finish the units, but they now have them, right? So these are all flooding into these markets right as the markets are correcting, right? The absolute worst time for that to happen. You also have things like the Airbnb bust going on right now, where you have these short-term Airbnb rentals that may not be penciling out anymore. So people are like, well, I got to dump the property then, right? So again, all these factors contribute to more supply. But then because of the liquidity, because of that massive spike in the chart you showed there, we pulled a ton of demand into the past few years.
Yep.
And so Nick is basically saying there's going to be a purchase drought now here in 2023, because the purchases that would have happened already happened, right? So to your point, he keeps asking the same question: where are the buyers going to come from to save the current prices, where, you know, given where they are right now? And so, like you, he expects prices to come down. In his mind, it's about a 30%, you know, national average when all is said and done here. Folks, if you're interested in digging further into this topic, that interview with Nick's a really good one to watch after this video. I'll put up a link to it right here. Okay, so that's housing, Lance, and everybody should go read your article there, and go to realinvestmentadvice.com to read it, not Zero Hedge.
I need the traffic.
All right. But I want to use that dot and connect it to a few others. So on this weekly show, you know, we talk about impending signs of recession, and there are a few others in addition to what's happening in housing that I just want to make sure are brightly on people's radars. The first is that Americans are getting into greater trouble with credit card debt. We've been sort of tracking this for a while, Lance, Bankrate just published a stat that says roughly 46% of credit card holders do not pay off their dues in full each month, and that's up from 39% a year ago. So pretty dramatic increase. Delinquency rates delinquency rates are rising amid all-time high interest rates. So as we've talked about, not only is credit card debt, revolving debt for the American consumer now back to an all-time high, it's increasing at the fastest rate really on record. I'm putting up a chart here so you can see that. And that debt is more expensive than it's ever been on record, right? Credit cards are charging the highest average APRs than they ever have. That is driving the American saving rate down to lows that we haven't really seen in the past 20 years, right? So the American consumer is really struggling here. From a similar report, consumers are getting slaughtered with maxed out credit cards and the highest interest rate in years, on top of 20 months of negative real wages. So real wages, even though nominally wages have been adjusted upward because of rising inflation, because inflation's been so high on a real adjusted or an inflation adjusted basis, they're actually negative, right? So people are losing purchasing power with their take-home pay for the past 20 months straight. Personal savings are getting wiped out, especially in the poorest of folks. Increasing risk of recession is coming, which has led to the emerging trend of people not being able to service their debts. And I'm putting up a chart here where you can see that, you know, real earnings are in this massive recession right now. And where I'm going with all this is I think we're going to see a ton of defaults in the future. So let me just give you a couple of indicators of that. So Goldman Sachs, which kind of famously got into the credit card business a few years ago, they partnered with Apple. That is now bleeding losses. Here's a quote from a recent article. People who are familiar with the unaudited stats told Bloomberg that when the latest quarterly figures get added to it next week, the cumulative loss they've had from this program will approach $4 billion in the past 3 years and $2 billion for the past year. So basically, you know, this thing that was touted as, all right, you know, Goldman's going to redefine personal lending and it's going to get in this whole new business. They're just getting their faces ripped off right now because of these defaults. And I did two really interesting interviews this week. I interviewed Peter Buchvar. That interview is already out. And one of his key themes was that the Fed has just broken the consumer's ability to afford a house or to afford a car, right? And you just went through the housing information. I did a great interview yesterday with Lucky Lopez, who is like an auto trader dealer. You know, I did an interview a couple months ago. I tried to get Lucky, but he was too busy. So I ended up interviewing the senior economist at Cox Automotive. And I got what I think was an honest, but very establishment point of view from them, which really was like, no, things still seem pretty good. We think the auto market's going to hold together pretty well next year. Lucky's story is like the polar opposite of that. And he's there on the front lines. I mean, he's there buying cars from dealers, dealing with creditors who are, you know, basically seeing these loans go bad at record levels. He's watching cars get repossessed. So he's got really, you know, close boots on the ground perspective there. And he basically just said, look, the dealers are playing every card they can right now not to let the public tune into the fact that they are getting stuck with a crap ton of cars that they can't afford and more inventory than they know what to do with at this point in time. So he's basically saying, look, expect lower prices ahead. He gives a very specific time frame this year when he thinks it's going to be the best time to buy a car. I'm going to not tell you folks that, so you go watch the interview with him. You know, he said the lenders are freaking out first because they're seeing the loans go bad, right? And during the pandemic, when everybody was, you know, rushing out to buy cars with their stimulus checks, the auto loan market was kind of like the housing loan market back in the 2007 era, where like anybody who could fog a mirror, they were giving loans to. They gave way more loans to people who had no business actually, you know, getting a loan to buy the cars, especially cars as high priced as they were. And not only is the default rate zooming higher right now, it's zooming higher not just in the weak end of the spectrum, but also in the prime end of the spectrum as well. And so that's really concerning. But you get crazy stats like there's the highest percentage of loans that have defaulted without making a single payment.
Oh, yeah.
So these guys are just driven off the lot and never made a payment on their cars, right? And what was super fascinating is he said what these people did is because of all the pandemic support, you know, regulations and stuff that in some cases are still in effect, is what they would do is they would go borrow some ridiculously expensive car they had no, or go buy some, borrow to buy some ridiculously expensive car they had no business getting, find a lender that was willing to give it to them, and they'd buy it from the dealer. And then they would immediately, like a couple of days later, they would call the lender and say, you know what, my personal situation changed. I can't afford this car anymore. So I need to go into forbearance. And so what forbearance did is it prevented the car from being repossessed from them. right? It was like the student loan moratorium that's on right now. So these guys got to drive like Porsches around for a year without paying anything for it, knowing very full well at the end of it, they were just going to let the car get repossessed, right? So there's a lot of gaming of the system going on right now. So long-winded way of just saying, you know, I think 2023, you mentioned it from our perspective here on this channel, it's going to be the year of the audible in terms of investing. I think it's going to be the year of the default in terms of the consumer, whether you're defaulting on your credit card, your auto loan, your mortgage.
Yeah. And look, you know, and it's terrible, right? We're going to see headline after headline coming out about how the auto industry took advantage of consumers. And because, you know, when you file, when you claim a forbearance, you know, a lot of people think that that's just a pause on my payments, right? So the bank just says that's the same thing as defaulting on your loan. And when you come back at some point, and when you get your car repoed, when you come back to get your next loan, yeah, good luck with that. You know, so, you know, the, you know, we're going to see, we saw a repair of credit scores, right? And we saw FICA, and some of the Fair Isaac company and a couple others, you know, they changed the dynamics of credit scoring to get credit scores to improve so more people could get loans, right? We do this every time. And so they all ran out and got loans. Now they've all gone into forbearance. They, you know, if you do a forbearance on your mortgage, it's going to come back to haunt you. If you did a forbearance on your car, it's going to come back to haunt you. You get a repossession, that's going to be a terrible outcome for you. There's going to be, you know, you think these millennials have problem with college student loan debt right now? Wait until all this other stuff comes back to haunt. So yeah, they're doing a lot of damage, and it's unfortunate. But you know, again, to one important point, you know, same thing with houses. All these people took stimulus, ran out, and bought cars. Who's going to be the next set of buyers, right?
Yeah. And I talked with Lucky about that specifically. And he said, absolutely, there's going to be a buyer drought because we just pulled all those purchases into 2021 and early 2022.
Exactly. So, all right, keep going.
All right. Trades. You gave a little bit of a nod to this at the beginning, but what trades have you guys made this week?
Basically, I've pretty much covered them. We bought a little bit of Goldman Sachs going into earnings. By the way, just real quick note on Goldman Sachs, because you mentioned it about their credit card business. Back in 2008, during the financial crisis, in order to get cover during the financial crisis, we were bailing out banks. And so General Electric and a bunch of other companies all filed to be a bank so they could get bailout money from the government. Goldman Sachs did the same thing. And that's why they have Marcus, which is their bank arm of their, you know, their white shoe, you know, investment banking business right. that we were doing for the last 100 years. So once they got that bank charter, they had to start doing banking. That was the whole issue with it, right? So that's when they came up with this credit card deal. That whole banking side has worked out terrible for them. They've lost money on the banking side. They've lost, you know, because you can't charge fees for anything, right? You can't charge fees for checking or ATM withdrawals or anything else. It's a loss leader business, and that's not their business. At the end of the day, they're still a white, you know, a white shoe firm,
yeah.
firm, right? They're not in this retail, you know, retail mess. I won't be surprised is that by the end of this year, if they aren't looking to exit that business entirely.
Yeah, we talked about this, and this is probably a topic for a future video because it's worth going into more deeply than we have time here. But, you know, I got my MBA at Stanford. I have a lot of peers that went to go work in high finance, big hedge funds, et cetera. And there's this thing they refer to. God's honest truth. They call it the money river.
Yeah.
And all these firms swim in it and live in it. And there's just this massive amount of money that sloshes around the planet. But you got to be in the inner circle to get access to it, right? And that's the world that Goldman lives in, right? And when you get into more sort of a banking, more retail oriented side of things, that's not the money river. That's just like a mosh pit. Right. And I think they're realizing, hey, it's a lot easier to make money when you just are swimming in it. But when you're over here, you know, this sucks.
Well, yeah. I mean, when you're doing investment banking, you're charging millions and millions of dollars in fees. And, you know, you get a guy with a $35 checking account. There's no money in that. You know, it's the same thing. Look, it's the same thing in my business. Right. I mean, you know, I would love to give financial advice and spend time with all of my staff helping everybody, no matter how much money you've got. I'm happy to help you. But, you know, if you've got $50 in the bank and you want to start investing, I can't justify that expense of the time and labor that I've got to pay people to do that. So, you know, this is why, you know, most financial advisory firms, they've got minimums, you know, $100,000, $500,000, whatever it is. because you got to get across that hurdle to where applying that time and expertise and expenses, you know, is justifiable on both sides, right? It's gonna be fair for the customer. It's gotta be fair for the advisor. In the banking world, it's not that way. It's just, you can't charge anybody anything because that's the competition level now. We used to charge for checks. You used to charge for checking. You used to charge for ATM withdrawals.
Right.
Every time you turn around, you get nickel and dime for stuff. And then everybody started complaining, like, you're taking all my money.
Right. but of course, you also did get a free toaster.
You did get a free toaster. Those were the days. But yeah. So I think Goldman's got to figure out how to exit out of that business. Anyway, but back to trades very quick. We added to our Goldman Sachs position. They announced earnings next week. Also, we are probably going to be adding to our United Healthcare position. They just reported earnings today. They were actually fairly decent, reaffirmed their outlook guidance. We recently added, we had sold energy back at the peak. We'd said that energy was just way too overbought, needed a correction. We've had a nice correction, so we're starting rebuilding some of our energy positions. And
are these nibbles or something more substantial than that?
Just nibbles right now. And again, you know, they've started to kind of move up, but you know, they're not real strong. So we're going to give them a little bit of room here and just kind of add into them. And then we added a 5% weight in the equal weight S&P 500 index earlier this week because we think this rally's got some more legs to it. So we'll see where we go over the next few days. We're about to increase our long duration bonds in our portfolio as well because we're about to get a fairly decent bullish buy signal on long duration bonds, which we were talking about last year. We've kind of been waiting for that to happen.
Yeah.
Getting very close to that. So maybe even next week, we might start be adding to our long duration bonds.
All right. And is that mostly individual bonds, a vehicle like TLT, which I know is like 20 years. It's not the full 30 year view. Yeah. So how are you getting your exposure right now for that?
So for a trading perspective, we'll use TLT.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
But in an individual bond portfolio, we'll buy actual bonds. So,
okay. I want to make this point real quickly. If we need to dig into it, we'll dig into it later on. But you talked about the challenge that faces every financial advisor, right? So that from a financial advisor standpoint, you know, you'd love to have, you know, 10 clients that have 100 million each, right?
Yeah,
then perfect. Yeah, then 10,000 clients who all have, you know, $100 each, right? The economies of scale are way better at the former than the latter, right? Now, you know, your firm and most other firms aren't structured that way. You are trying to help as many people as you can. And I just want to underscore for folks, one of the things that I really like about your firm, and it was a factor in partnering up with you, was the fact that you're there to help anybody, right? And we have these free consultations that we talk about. So even if you don't take them on, you're happy to help guide people with, you know, whatever limited bandwidth you guys have. But also, you guys have a I don't want to call it a robo solution, but you basically have sort of an opportunity for people who don't qualify to get the full attention of a fully managed account because their assets are below a certain level, but you don't turn them away. You say, hey, look, you can be in our general portfolio. You just don't get, you know, all the custom attention that you would if you had more assets, because we just literally, you know, can't afford to, you know, with our bandwidth, but also we can do less with what you have, but we can allocate your lower amount of capital just across the way we deploy it in our general model portfolio. And if you want to ride the RIA portfolio train, you can. Am I doing a good job of explaining this?
Yeah, it sounds terrible, but yeah, that sounds right. And again, I just, you know, it's the point is, and look, I personally, if I could work for free, and you know, if you would just pay all my living expenses, Adam, I'll work for free because I love what I do.
Done.
And yeah, I love what I do, and I'd love to just, you know, sit around all day and help everybody. But you know, I've got to pay employees, I've got to pay rent, I've got to, you know, pay staff, and you know, all these type of things, and you know, healthcare benefits, cost, all that stuff. So, you know, so it's a lot of resources that go into managing relationships. So for instance, you know, I manage the portfolio, you know, John Penn, Richard Russo, Danny Ratliff, they do all the financial planning. And there's just a lot of time and expense that goes into that. So, you know, we've tried to come up with a solution that says, look, if you just need the portfolio because you're just getting started, you really don't, if you're just starting saving and going, you don't really need a financial plan right now. But let's just get you into, let's get you into a savings program, and let's get you going and get your portfolio allocated. We can do that for you. We've got a solution for that. It's low cost, get you to where you're going. And then as you kind of grow up and you do your job of saving money and building your net worth, then you'll graduate into the full-blown program. And then we'll start doing financial planning, all that type of stuff. It'll make sense for you to pay that cost at that point. It'll make sense for us to charge that cost. So, you know, we want to make sure that in all of our relationships that it's a fair deal. You know, you're getting a good value for your portfolio. And it's also a good value for us. It's got to be an equal exchange. And, you know, this is why I posted this chart on Twitter this morning. And I have to go back and I'll dig it up for you real quick. But I posted this chart. It was the most respected and disrespected, it was the most trusted and least trusted professions in the country, right? So number one, most trusted profession in the country, nurses. Everybody trusts nurses. Nurses and teachers right there at the top, right where they should be. At the very bottom, Congress.
Yeah.
Least trusted. And I said, you know, financial advisors probably fall somewhere between congressmen and, you know, whatever was just right above it. And the reason is because the financial industry has done such a poor job of, you know, treating their customers. Well, they sell product, they put people into annuities without, you know, really understanding what they are. They just pay a high commission. And, you know, we go through all that, right? You know, it's just been decades of just really bad service financial advisors provided. So, you know, our whole kind of core business is making sure we provide a really good value for the services we provide, but we also want to make sure that it's a good value for you on your side as well.
Yeah. And the reason why I just wanted to harp on this was, you know, I get hit all the time with people saying, you know, hey, can I talk to one of your advisors? Because I mean, I don't know what it takes in terms of how much, you know, how many assets you need to have to get like a live person to pay attention to you. I mean, Lance, you'd be amazed at the people who come to me who have like, you know, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars, or some cases a million or more. And they're like, and they still don't give me a live person to talk to. Right. And I want to make sure that, you know, when I talk about people, you know, going and having a chat, a free consultation with one of Wealthion's advisors, I don't want them to think like, oh, I only have $75,000. I guess it's not for me. I guess I just fall below the line. The answer is no. You know, your firm specifically has that ability to participate in the general portfolio. And then once your assets get to a point where you qualify above the threshold, well, then you graduate into the full-blown thing, right? So there's a path for people to be able to pursue and aspire to. So I just wanted to give people, you know, hope there in that story. All right. So we're in the last couple of minutes here. A few things I still want to get through. One is just a positive celebration here. Right before we came on to record here, Lance, I put a chart up on Twitter which shows the lifetime views for the Wealthion YouTube channel. Yeah. And you can see that we're really cooking with gas at this point in time. We had a very important inflection moment around Labor Day of last year, where if you're looking at the chart, you can see I was pretty happy with where we were coming into Labor Day in terms of what we've been able to achieve in terms of viewership. But something really changed, and we have an entirely new trajectory. And you can see, you know, the numbers kind of speak for themselves. In the year, little over a year and a half of the lifetime of this channel, we've got 27 million views. I'm doing this from memory. I don't have the chart in front of me. I think it's you know, something like 12 million you know, human hours of watching material, which is pretty amazing. I think 212 subscribers at this point in time. So it's just a way, I love celebrating a win with all the viewers that make this possible, and with a, you know, key partners like you, Lance. So, good for Wealthion. Hopefully this is just, the beginning of, you know, future greatness we're headed towards in terms of really making a big difference in the world, but it's nice to see that the world is enjoying what we're doing. And again, I just want to give my absolute heartfelt gratitude to everybody who's helped make this a reality. Every one of you watching, we literally could not be doing this without you. So thank you. I want to conclude here with a story, Lance. We talk about the Fed, we talk about Congress, we talk about the people that are running corporate America. And we put a lot of faith in these people, and you know, there's a lot of things that come up that make a you know, somebody who watches the system closely and is a critical thinker maybe scratch their head and say, should we be letting these guys run the system this much? I was reminded, I was talking with an old friend of mine, a buddy of mine from childhood, and he and I started our first the first jobs we ever had, we started together. We started a little business called Odd Jobs, and we just literally went and did odd jobs at people's houses. And our first job was working for this lawyer in our town. And we grew up in a little tiny town in Connecticut, and it was on the Connecticut River. And this guy had a really nice house right on the banks of the Connecticut River. And we did a bunch of, you know, brush clearing for him. We mowed lawns. We just did a bunch of, you know, grunt work. And one day he called me and said, hey, I need your help. I've got a bunch of driftwood that came into my, you know, the bank of the river by my house. I want to get rid of it. So I showed up, and he's there standing on top of this massive pile of driftwood that he had, you know, pulled together. And he gets out a jerry can of gasoline. And it's clear he wants to burn it. And so he's sort of throwing the gasoline all over the pile of driftwood. It climbs up to the top. I'm watching, and he reaches into his pocket and he pulls out a matchbook. And I'm 14. I don't really know how the world works at this point in time, but I'm thinking, it seems maybe a little dangerous. But I'm thinking, hey, this guy, he's an adult. He knows what he's doing. He's a smart guy. He was a lawyer. He owned this big house by the river. I'm sure he knows what he's doing. Well, he lights the match and just disappears in a massive fireball. He jumps off of the burning pile of driftwood into the water, you know, douses himself, comes back to shore. I pull him out of the water. I'm like, wow, are you okay? He clearly is shooken up by the whole experience. He says, no, I think I'm okay. I just, I guess it was a little bit more volatile than I was expecting. And as we're talking, I see his face begin to turn kind of a mild pink, and then a deep pink, and then just like a beet red. And I'm like, I think you might need to go to the hospital. And he goes off, and fortunately he's okay. He comes back later that day. He's all bandaged up. He's got some pretty serious burns. The point is, I feel like a lot of the times we're like the 14-year-old version of me when we watch the Fed, when we watch what's going on in Congress, when we watch a lot of the decisions the guys that are running the banking system or whatnot are doing, where we're saying, okay, surely these guys know what they're doing. They're smart people, right? But a lot of times, especially now, you know, I think they're playing with forces that could explode on them the same way that you know, jerry can of gasoline did for this guy. So anyways, I just thought it was sort of an apt analogy of the time we're living in. And I guess the moral of the story is, we really need to be much more critically thinking and questioning of what these guys are doing. And more importantly, since our agency in the national story is relatively low as an individual person, is just saying, okay, what steps can I be taking to make myself less vulnerable to these idiots if they end up lighting the match on top of the pile of driftwood? You're laughing as I'm saying this.
No, I'm. Yeah, it's a sad situation, because I do think they eventually light the match on top of the wood. So, you know, I think it's important. You know, hopefully some sanity will return at some point. You know, there's always the story of the pendulum, right? We have to swing too far in one direction. You know, I think we definitely got there over the last couple of years, and I think we're starting to see some sanity returning a bit. You know, we'll see. That takes a long time. But I think at some point, you know, the average person starts to figure out that, look, if I want to, you know, I want to live a happy, healthy, normal life, I've got to have things available to me. You know, we're moving back towards, you know, the economics of things, and how those things work economically. And unfortunately, we've gotten really detached from that. You know, it sounds great to have free everything, you know, free college, free healthcare, all sounds great. No evidence whatsoever that actually works out well in creating better prosperity, right, and better health or anything else for the population at all. So, you know, I think we'll see that come back eventually. Hopefully we don't have to go into a really deep depression to figure that out first, you know, but unfortunately it's taken pretty big downturns in order to get people to change, you know, change direction. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, we'll see. And look, I'll quit beating this horse bloody, but you know, you just look at the Fed, right? I mean, we were trusting the Fed when, I mean, we can keep going back to bad decisions the Fed made, but even in recent memory, right, where, okay, the Fed had to step in because it was a global pandemic and we shut down the global economy, you know, okay, they had to do something. But did they have to do as much as they did along with the fiscal stimulus? And then, of course, all through 2021, you know, they just kept the pedal to the metal, right? When it was really clear that they didn't need to be doing that anymore, they ended up creating the situation that we've now been paying for with this massively higher inflation that everybody wants, right? They've now had to, you know, shift gears, and maybe we can say they're doing the right thing now. But there's a lot of people, Lance, that sort of like you say, the Fed should just stop. They have tightened too much already. And they may be creating a tremendously worse recession at the end of the day here than would otherwise need to be had, right? I don't know yet. We're not going to know until the results are in later this year. But again, at each one of these points, the general populace has just sat there and said, okay, well, I guess the Fed knows what it's doing, right? Right. And, you know, every time we're having to deal with the mess that they create here. So anyways, I'm done.
You know, but you know, the key thing is that, you know, you said something there, and you said the Fed had to step in. Did they? You know,
sure. Yeah, that should be debated, right? But I think at the time, everybody assumed, okay.
Yeah, everybody just said ever since the financial crisis, right? It's like, oh, every time there's a downturn, the Fed has to take care of it. The problem is the Fed keeps trying to take care of this stuff. And we need to have and this sounds terrible, I'm sorry, but we need to have a good cleansing event. You know, it sounds terrible. Look, people are going to lose their houses, they're going to lose their jobs, it's going to be terrible for a couple of years. But you got to get back to how an economy actually functions. And, you know, we're carrying so much debt that is a lot of it's bad debt, you know, that you've just got to get this stuff off the books at some point and kind of reset the table for people, for the economy to work. And then it'll create economic prosperity for the population as a whole, rather than those at the top 10%. So,
yeah. You know, well, I'm there with you on Lance for president. The problem with that is, back to my analogy, is
nobody wants to do it. Nobody wants the pain.
Nobody running it. Well, nobody wants the pain. Every citizen loves that idea. Oh, you're right. Let's get back to a freer and fairer and more sustainable system. Nobody willingly wants to take that pain, except for crazies like you and I that just say we'll be better off if we do it right. But I can tell you, nobody running the system wants that to happen, yeah, right? So the entire power structure is fighting against you. And the public is still more or less willingly just saying, okay, I believe these guys are doing the right thing, right? They're the smart ones, right? So anyways.
I'm gonna run for president 2024. So if y'all all want to vote for me, just write me in and, you know, we'll fix it. We'll fix this horse, right?
All right. I'm sure we're going to get a firestorm in the comments of people saying, Lance, you better be serious. Okay. Well, in wrapping up here, folks, just want to give you some advanced news here. We do a conference for Wealthion every year. We do one earlier in the year, one later in the year. I've just locked in the date for our next conference. It's going to be Saturday, March 18th. If you've been to our previous online conferences, this is all online. You know what I'm talking about when I say it is a phenomenal experience. I will be coming forward with the details on future programs for here. I just wanted to mention it to folks so you can mark your calendars. And yes, you alumni of previous events, you're going to get advance notice from us and get the lowest price for buying because you are a previous alumnus. That's one of the benefits of that program. But everybody else, just again, mark your calendar and expect to hear more from me over the next couple of weeks on the details and who's presenting. And already have about 2/3 of the roster lined up, Lance. It's already a killer lineup. It's going to be great. All right. And then just wrapping up here, folks, as we say every week, you know, the year of the audible, as Lance said, a lot of uncertainty. It's going to be very interesting. I'm sure it's going to be very volatile. So if you are trying to navigate your wealth through this minefield and murkiness, highly, highly recommend that you work with a professional financial advisor who understands all the macro risks and issues that Lance and I have been talking about here to help guide you through it. If you've got a good one, great, stick with them. But if you don't, or if you'd like a second opinion from one who does, maybe even Lance and his team there at RIA, just go fill out the short form at wealthion.com to schedule a free consultation with one of those advisors. Totally free, doesn't cost you anything. There's no commitment to work with these guys. It's just a public service that they offer. And Lance already gave, you know, a much better commercial for his reasons for doing that than I can hear. But I just want to make sure that everybody is working with a good guide here. And then last, if you enjoy these weekly market recaps, Want to see more of them in 2023? Whether you do, whether you don't, Lance and I are going to make them anyways, but I hope you like them. So do us a favor and support this channel by hitting the like button, then clicking on the red subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. Lance, buddy, thanks for another great week. I'll let you have the last word here.
That's it. I'll see you next week.
All right. Everybody else, thanks so much for watching.